Since we've already had the joy of the Fischer glucostereochemistry proof in lecture today, I thought we would tackle some smaller topics in here, because there are several derivatives of sugar that your textbook really mentions, including the aldaric acid that we were using in that proof. And we need to talk about glycosides, which are derivatives of sugars, and in fact, it's the way that you can link one sugar to another to make complex sugars. And so that's what we're going to end up with today, with disaccharides like sucrose, which is table sugar. So first, a few derivatives. This should be easy. Which sugar is this? Mannose. D-mannose. What do you think you're going to get if you reduce mannose with sodium borohydride? An alcohol. So the aldehyde will be reduced down to an alcohol functionality. So every carbon on the molecule will just have an alcohol. Good night. Stop that. As a functional group, this is called an aldetol. And so this particular one would be D-mannitol. Someone with one of these little electronic devices could look this up because I suddenly blanked on it. But I know that sorbitol, which you might have heard of as an artificial sweetener as such, that's an aldetol, which I believe is from sucrose. But before I write that down, if anyone feels like looking that up while I continue here. It's one of your derivatives you need to know. That mechanism you're already familiar with. Here's one that I need to look the mechanism up for. Which sugar is this? Tallose, right? Turns out that if I oxidize with aqueous bromine, it is able to oxidize just the aldehyde but leave every other position on the molecule untouched. So it's a carboxylic acid, but only at one end of the molecule, the end that used to be the anomer. So this is an aldonic acid. And specifically, this would be D-talonic acid. Notice that a lot of the terms that we have that end in "-ose," in some way or another, or this aldehyde prefix that we've got, you can interchange different endings to express all these different functional groups. So we had pyranose, that we could tack onto the name of glucose and say things like glucopyranose, glucofuranose. Same thing's going on here. I've shown mannose going to mannitol. We could have glucitol, iditol. Just add itol to the name where os would go. And same thing here. Just drop the os and add onic acid, and that's an aldonic acid. Last derivative, which we saw in class, was if we did oxidize with nitric acid instead. Let's see, what is this sugar?
Blue.
Gulos, that's right. And nitric acid. Of course, concentrated nitric acid for too long a time under heat is going to oxidize lots of stuff. But under more controlled conditions, lower temperatures, it's able to selectively oxidize primary alcohols and aldehydes. And that's an aldaric acid. So this would be D-gularic acid. Questions? So next, we're going to work towards this thing called a glycoside, as I said a minute ago. But before we get there, I want to come back to this issue of cyclization, because we are going to be drawing several structures of cyclic sugars today. What is this sugar? Glucose, one of my favorites, apparently. What are we going to get if we have that in an acidic solution? And I'll say aqueous, but I'm not going to list water as a reagent. That's if you have super-duper concentrated sulfuric acid. But I'm talking about just a mild acid, even a, let's say, a pH 5 solution. A full acetal or a hemiacetal? Well, to do things a little out of order, what I did with the other section, let's draw the alpha D pyranose form of glucose. But let's not go through the process of drawing it in a linear structure and then cyclizing it and then turning the bottom stereocenter, then flopping the structure sideways. Let's make some realizations, some shortcuts that we could make. Oh, why am I doing it like that? We haven't done chair structures of sugars yet. So if I wanted to do a Haworth projection, and again, I'm working on alpha D glucopyranose. For D sugars, the CH2OH group is always going to be at the top of the ring if you do the Haworth projection in the standard configuration. Because remember, we do this rotation of the bottom stereocenter when trying to go from the linear to the cyclic form of the sugar. And for D sugars, every single time, since the D means that the bottom stereocenter is on the right, that means every single time we're going to turn that stereocenter clockwise when we're trying to do that visualization. That means the CH2OH group always goes to the left-hand position on this Fischer projection when you have it drawn correctly. Since when you tip it over, things on the left end up on the top, then again, on Haworth projections for D aldohexoses, that CH2OH group is always going to be up. Although I'm recommending it as a shortcut, I would practice the long way a time or two so you can prove to yourself that this is going to be correct. Now, once we know the configuration of that CH2OH group, remember that the alpha form of it is such that the OH group at the anomer position is trans to the CH2OH group. So again, for D sugars, alpha is always going to be down. Then what's the normal configuration of glucose? Well, we got it right there. It's right, left, right, right. Right always ends up on the bottom of Hayworth projections. Left always ends up on the top. So if I can look at the line of the projection itself, the ring, and I can imagine right, left, right, the first three stereocenters. Then I can put them directly on the ring. Now, when you get a question asking you to draw this on the exam, if you need to do it the long way, that's fine. And when I did it this morning, it took me about 50 seconds, working at a decent pace, which means 2.5 minutes maximum, but absolute maximum. That's actually way too long to have to sit there to just write one molecule out. Because as you're going to see, we're going to start working on linking these units together. So you got to get to the point where you're fairly proficient jumping from the name to the structure to its cyclic structure. All right. So now let me look a value up really quickly here. So the optical rotation, which I know we don't talk about numbers very often, but there's a reason I want to mention it just briefly here. Alpha D glucose has what's called a specific rotation of 112.2 degrees. Means over a certain distance of length, which I think for specific notation is 1 centimeter. It's been long enough, I'm forgetting. It's 1 centimeter or 1 decimeter. But over that fixed length, light will rotate by 112.2 degrees, and positive number means clockwise. If that is the optical rotation of the alpha version of the sugar, what would the rotation of the beta form be? Ah. You just fell into my trap. Why? Because what is the relationship between the alpha and the beta forms? What's a stereochemical term to describe their relationship? They're what? Because when we were developing this as a topic, well, the stereoisomers, yes, because they got the same bonds, and alpha and beta just, it's whether that anomer position is pointed up or down. But what do we call the relationship between the two compounds then? They are, right? What's the part? What are enantiomers? Mirror images. Are the alpha and beta, what did you say?
Anomer.
They are anomers. I just said the word, anomer position. Alpha and beta are not enantiomers. They are epimers. D and L sugars are enantiomers of each other, which means everything's a mirror image. If you only have one stereocenter that's different, which is the only thing different between the alpha and beta forms, those are epimers. What is the relationship between enantiomers in terms of optical rotation? They're opposite because they're mirror images. What is the relationship between epimers? But what's the optical rotation effect? Like, what's the relationship in optical rotation between epimers? None. There is no relationship because they're different compounds. They're not mirror images. So their optical rotation is going to depend exactly on where the atoms are located. Since they're different compounds, there's no comparison, there's no way to predict it. So if I asked you what would be the optimal rotation of alpha L-glucopyranose, then the answer to that would have been a negative 112. But a beta D-glucopyranose, we'd have to look it up because there's no way to predict it. Let me point out that little stereochemical truth, because it's a rather important point. Let me say that again with dramatic emphasis. This change in the optical rotation is a significant observation. Means test question. Knowing the optical rotation of the alpha D form of glucose does not help in determining the optical rotation of beta D form of glucose. Since the two are epimers, not enantiomers. So there is no relationship between their optical activities. So, yes? They are one little letter. Okay, now next situation. So if I take the alpha D form, pyranose form of glucose, which as a pure compound has an optical rotation in solution of 112.2 degrees, I put it back in solution, just leave it there. Eventually, its optical rotation is going to shift to 52.7 degrees. It's going to be my question. Why? Why do you think that could happen? What's going to happen to this compound if you put it in acid and water? Well, hydration, but of what? Of the what?
Of the acid.
What functional group is this, by the way? Very typical kind of MCAT question. What functional group is this? What is it? Lactone? Do you see a carbonyl anywhere in there? Ester? Do you see a carbonyl in there anywhere? Ether. Sort of. When we have a carbon with two oxygens on it, it's one of four functional groups. Hemiacetal, acetal, hemiketal, or ketal. Right? Your Chem 12B chemistry coming back to haunt you here. This is a hemiacetal. Why is it an acetal? Because we have the hydrogen. Why is it only a hemiacetal? Because one of the oxygens has a hydrogen. Are hemiacetals normally isolatable? Do you all need to? Oh. Should I do my Keanu Reeves impersonation now? The Matrix? Or how about just do the rest of the lecture like this, you know? Anyways. Are hemiacetals normally isolatable?
No.
What would happen to them in acidic solution? They would open back up again. If it opens up, doesn't it have another chance to close, and instead of making the alpha form, make the beta form instead? What if I only had the beta form? The beta form has an optical rotation of plus 18.7 degrees. Notice that 52 is not the average of those two numbers, which means there's not necessarily a 50-50 proportion of these two epimers in solution. In fact, the exact equilibrium concentration of the two forms depends on exactly the unique types of intramolecular interactions you have, due to this being a molecule filled with OH groups. So every sugar is going to have a different balance. But the point is that in every aldohexose, when it cyclizes into its pyranose form, you get the alpha-beta forms that can interconvert very easily, very rapidly. So you put either of the two pure forms in solution, over time they both attain the same equilibrium optical rotation because they become a mixture of epimers, and this process is known as mutarotation. So again, whenever a pure sample of an alpha or beta aldopyranose is placed in solution, the alpha and beta forms will interconvert. Achieving an equilibrium between the two forms with an equilibrium optical activity. That is mutarotation. With an equilibrium optical activity, which means they both have their each individual optical activities. They reach this common one, which is what occurs at equilibrium. So, no, actually, I did mean not equal, but equilibrium optical activity. Questions about mutarotation. So let me show you that technically, if you take glucose and put it in solution, it forms alpha D glucofuranose plus alpha D glucopyranose plus beta D glucopyranose plus beta D glucopyranose. No, not at all. Because for several of the sugars, the six-membered ring form may be more favorable than the five-membered ring form. And then, again, due to intramolecular effects, the alpha versus the beta position, one might be more favorable than the other. For example, depending on how many of the other alcohol groups are axial or equatorial, you might have the alpha position go equatorial to avoid steric hindrance, or it might be forced axial depending on the remaining substituents. And so for each sugar, it's different as far as whether it's alpha or beta form is more or less favorable, and whether it's five or six membered ring form is more or less favorable. So the exact percentage for each sugar is unique to the types of intramolecular interactions that occur once it cyclizes. Did I do it again? Oh. Better now? So questions on any of this to do with the cyclization? Okay, then let's move to the next subtopic, where we're finally going to talk about this glycoside. Now let's stick with glucose. What's going to happen when I take glucose and put in solution that's got a little acid and then methanol? And if you tell me that I'm going to form a glycoside, I'm going to come virtually smack you. Glycoside, glycoside, glycoside. Someone suggest what's going to happen mechanistically. Oh, poof.
I won't kill the picture because I know you're going to elaborate it when I'm not looking.
Can't beat them, join them, right? Where did I just put that? Oh. I still don't have an answer.
I know we don't have an answer, Dr. Gray, but
What if this were Chem-12B and I gave you this molecule? You know, forget that it's a carbohydrate, it's a hemiacetal. What happens when a hemiacetal reacts with an excess of alcohol? forms a full acetal, correct?
Correct.
Through some version of protein open-attacking protein, right? Well, what form of protein open-attacking protein is going to happen here? Slightly different than what you're used to, because to decompose the ring, we would have the ring get protonated open, and then another sequence of events occurs. But it's not the mechanism. Instead happens like this. Yes, we protonate, but we protonate the anomeric position. Well, all of them are going to get protonated at one point or another. But apparently what causes the formation of a glycoside is this particular attack. Which after protonate, we have open and attack. Well, look at what the attack is. That the oxygen that is part of the ring assists the departure of the water. Why does that matter? Because it means we form a planar intermediate. So when methanol comes in, it's able to attack either from above or below. The attack is not going to be 50-50 in proportion, and exactly what that proportion is, we'll discuss that topic our next lecture. It is something known as the anomeric effect, but I don't want to get into it today because it's going to distract us from our main goal of getting to what a glycoside is and how that relates to disaccharides. So all that matters is we do get two products. We're going to get an alpha and a beta form. Are we comfortable with me saying minus H plus so I don't have to write these structures another time just to show that losing hydrogen? Because remember, when methanol attacks, we're going to end up with oxygen being positively charged on the methanol, and it has to deprotonate. They're not two arrows. What I'm trying to show is two products form.
Also one,
one attacks the top, or it could attack from the bottom. So everyone that is writing without looking or listening, because I had a couple of people a bit irate with me after the exam saying, but you had this in your notes, and they showed me something written. And I said, yes, that's what was written. What was I saying at that moment? Right? So yeah, you might write it down, and one of those example points is when I used hydroxide to deprotonate an enolate, even though there was an ester present. It was one of those cases like malonic ester synthesis. Hydroxide's acceptable, but only if you use it the right way. Same thing here. I'm using the two arrows to show the two possibilities. If you chose to do the same thing on an exam, I would understand what you meant, trying to show the two possibilities. If I only ask you for one of them, you wouldn't write a forked arrow like that. So, anyways, methanol attacks, pushes the double bond open, and then methanol needs to lose a proton. So that's what the minus H plus is. And again, saving the question of how much of each of these forms for another day, we could say there are two products that form. An alpha form where the methoxy group is trans to the back CH2OH. And the beta form where it's cis. Otherwise, the molecules would be identical. So before we had a hemiacetal, now we have a true acetal, which is tougher to decompose. You would have to hydrolyze this in order to break it back into being just normal glucose. Whereas if you have just the cyclic form of glucose, just a hint of water and acid will get that to pop open. So there's a difference in stability of sugars with glycosidic linkages versus just plain old sugars. The IDE ending in glycoside literally means child of, or I think specifically son of. IDE ending. It's something I remember from back in college when we had to read Greek dramas. Because a lot of people are blah, 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 idis. Their names end in that. Means son of, like that. So chloride is the offspring of chlorine, for example. Glucoside is the offspring of glucose. You've made a derivative of glucose. Now, this is if we just took plain old methanol. What would happen if we took glucose and reacted it with glucose? Yes, sir. Which one were? All the steps? Oh, there, because I don't feel like making us suffer anymore about worrying about how much of it's reversible or not. So I'll make a blatant statement like this. Were this focusing on mechanism, I'd worry more about the arrow. Since I'm focusing on the transformation, I don't care about the arrow. Will I allow you to ignore the same things on the exam? Yes, because I'm testing in this case not for can I catch you on a reversibility step? But do you know what a glycoside is and how to get there? Is that a reasonable answer to a reasonable question? Yes. What? Feelings. Nothing more than feelings. Oh, I need the end of the quarter as badly as you all do, so. I know the answer to that. Just give us all A's and be done with it. But no, I actually want to teach you something, too. So why don't we go on to the question of what will happen if we react glucose with glucose? We get maltose, one of the disaccharides. What is a disaccharide? Well, what's a monosaccharide? It does literally mean one sugar unit, yes. There's some probably really carefully worded definition of monosaccharide that I should know, but I don't, so I'm going to give you mine instead. It means you've only got one sugar unit in it. All the sugars that we've studied so far have a carbonyl. Of course, when you cyclize, you lose the carbonyl, but it's still buried in there. But none of these sugars have been linked to other sugar units yet. And so that's why they're all classified as monosaccharides. A disaccharide would be a complex sugar created by taking two individual sugars and joining them through a glycosidic link. There are four disaccharides I would like us to know. Sucrose, table sugar. Maltose, which when you order a malt, that's what that means, that you've added maltose, another consumable sugar. We have lactose. And then there's a derivative of cellulose, a sugar unit that pops out when you decompose cellulose, and that's cellulose. We're going to get through at least two of these today, because that's as far as we got in the other section. And then I will give you some strong encouragement to practice drawing sucrose on your own. That's the trickiest one. But let's do maltose first, since I mentioned that first, because it's nothing more than a dimer of glucose. Now, I'm pretty sure I've said these terms more than one time in the past, but if we've got mono and di, then there's these prefixes, oligo, which means several, and poly, which means many. So an oligosaccharide would be a larger sugar with a few units, and a polysaccharide would be something like starch, which is an indefinite number of sugar units linked together. Yes?
So, is it all eight sugars can make
dimer? Yes, but maybe they're not all biologically important, nor may they all exist. Some of these sugars cannot be found in isolated form. Now, which ones are which, that I'm not a carbohydrate chemist, but I know that you don't find all of them naturally. So let's look at this maltose, because it is, in fact, a dimer of the alpha-D-pyranose form of glucose. So, in fact, one version of the proper name for maltose is 4-O. Alpha D gluco pyranosyl alpha D gluco pyranose. Say ten times fast. That. I said say that 10 times fast. I just did, didn't I? Shall we translate that into English or into chemicalese? Yes. It is a D. So what does this mean? Well, it's two alpha-D-glucopyranoses that you're doing something with. So let me draw two of those sugar units. Now, I have not connected these yet, because I want to talk about it before I finish making the connection. So one sugar is a substituent to the other, and the way that often these are written is to put the sugar that is the end, the one where the end number position can open easily, put it on the right. So as the name is, 4-O-something, alpha-D-glucopyranose. The alpha-D-glucopyranose part we're already fine with. We've seen that kind of thing before. What does the O mean? It means we're substituting not at carbon number 4, but the oxygen attached to carbon number 4, which, since the carbonyl is the top of a molecule, it also is also where we number from in a carbohydrate. That's position 1, 2, 3, 4. So there's an oxygen that's supposed to go there. On that oxygen, we have a substituent. What is that substituent? Glucopyranose in its alpha D form. Connected through its anomeric position, where we would have glucopyranoside would technically be its name, but the substituent name, ide, goes to ill, so we get glucopyranosyl, which means it looks like this. Now, if you're unsatisfied with that curved bond, well, you wouldn't be the first one. But this is what I was trying to warn you about previously, that in order to draw this compound or some of these disaccharides correctly or in a way that the bonds make sense, you have to draw them with using Hayworth projections that are not in their standard configuration. So the Hayworth projections we always been doing have been taking those Fischer projections, just tipping them to the side. The enamer goes on the right, and the enamer oxygen goes on the back. But if I want to make that bond not twisted, I have to flip the molecule 180 degrees over on paper, which means that what was on top is now on the bottom, and what was in back is now in front. The common mistake made at this point is to do only one of those two things, to switch the top and the bottoms. If I switch all the top and the bottom so the bond was pointed the correct way, well, that's the mirror image of that portion of the sugar. That's the enantiomer of that portion of the sugar, so it would be L-glucose if I did that. If I swap the front and the back, that's again inverting the molecule, making a mirror image, which again means I'm making the L form of the sugar. But if I both swap the front back positions and swap the top and the front, that is the same thing as a 180 degree rotation. And since I did a double reflection, I made the mirror image, which means I got the original compound back again. So if I wanted to take this and turn it, just this portion, 180 degrees, here's what I get. Yes. Of course it is. Question was asked, is this useful if you see it with a model? I say, of course it is, because for most people, visualizing in 3D is not an obvious thing, and so most people are assisted by using the models. Yes. Now, if you're just born lucky and you can visualize anything, then it won't help you. Now, notice I've circled the alpha of this maltose and pointed to one particular OH group. And this is an idea we'll come back to after we finish seeing the other disaccharides. The back part of the molecule, the left-hand unit, that's trapped. It is a full acetal. The front part here, where I've pointed at, is a hemiacetal. The hemiacetal, remember, as I said a moment ago, opens more easily than a regular acetal. So the front part of this molecule can easily open, close, still, which means there's an alpha form of maltose and a beta form that depends on the configuration of that openable anomeric position. That's maltose. Let's see our last sugar for today, which is lactose. If we can tolerate going over it. If you're lactose intolerant, oh, there we go. What is lactose? It is 4-O beta D galactopyranosyl alpha D glucose. Pyranos. What does that mean? We have a unit of galactose that is the back unit, you could say. And we have a unit of glucose that is the front unit. I happen to know that I did this backwards. But I don't want to waste that much of the whiteout. So I will Photoshop this part. Oh, I know. And I'm doing it again. Hold on. Who invented such beautiful things? Okay, so the right-hand side is alpha-glucopyranose. We should be able to do that. Alpha for D sugars is down. Glucose itself is right, left, right. Then because the last one's on the right, when we twist it around, that means the top CH2OH is on the top. Galactose, what is the pattern for OH groups in its linear form? So right, left, left, right. Right, left, left, and then the back one, again, it's a D sugar, so it's up. Again, technically, the right-hand endomeric position could open more easily, and so we could potentially have an alpha and a beta form of lactose as well. So next time we discuss the disaccharides, we'll do cellulose and sucrose. And as I had probably already indicated, I suggest practicing doing sucrose.